A Senior Dad Download. Stan Goldberg talks with Barry Blessa, February 2007. I Hear You, Part 1. We're faced with more kids having disabilities today than ever before. Now, I don't know whether it's environmental or some other reason that it's happening, but we're having more kids with problems with autism and whatever. And now, autistic kids are very sensitive to sound. How can we make the classroom friendlier for these kind of kids?
Well, first, I'd like to challenge the fact that we don't actually know things have gotten worse. What we do know is everybody's now sensitive and is willing to talk about it and make it public and expect additional services. Maybe it's gotten worse, maybe it hasn't gotten worse. We don't actually know that, but we're clearly more sensitive to it. As for making the classroom better, you first have to back off into the question, what is the problem? And this is really the part where I get very passionate. Most professionals who are trained at some skill set define all problems based on the tools they have in their toolbox to solve them. So if you own a hammer, everything is a nail. And there isn't a lot of incentive to actually go into these situations and say, sort of like an anthropologist doing field work, what's the problem? How do we understand the phenomenon? How do we do our field work so we're not skewing the results for some private agenda? So that's really the first step. Since I haven't done the field work and I've just formed an opinion based on what other people are telling me and common sense, I can offer a very speculative opinion, but it's not researched and it shouldn't be taken as truth. Your question had in it an implicit assumption, which may be quite true, that these kids are sensitive to sound. Now, if you mean all sounds, that they're hypersensitive and hypervigilant to sounds, which may very well be true because I've heard that kind of statement elsewhere. In fact, I had one psychiatrist write me that he was dealing with a patient who was so hypersensitive that any sound in her building would wake her up. Then you've made the statement that the problem is sound reduction and essentially sound absorption, sound isolation, and cutting down the amount of extraneous stimulation because they don't have the filter to suppress it. Now, if you make that statement, the techniques are well known. They've been known for the better part of a century. They're not that expensive. They're not that cheap. Sound isolation is one discipline which is understood, and sound absorption from within the space. And basically, you're saying that sounds generated outside the environment you don't want to get in, and sounds that are in the environment you want to be absorbed so they don't get amplified by the spatial acoustics. So to answer your question, yes, we can do it. We know how to do it if the assumptions are what we stated. And then it becomes political. Who pays for it?
Well, it's always a question of who pays for it.
Right. And that basically, now it gets a little bit more complicated because in one group, a group of parents were trying to improve the classroom environment for their kids. And they put up relatively inexpensive but potentially effective sound absorption material. The fire marshal in the town objected violently because they hadn't considered the fire retardant qualities of what they were putting up and made them take it down. He was right. They were right. Obviously, it was a lack of understanding of how you actually implement something.
Did they then put up material that was satisfactory for the fire marshal?
I think the issue was cost. They couldn't figure out who to get to pay for it.
The second time?
Yeah. Because the first time, I think they just used sort of home materials, which would have been effective. I guess actually the first step was going to be rugs. Or maybe this was another case, and some other parents said, yes, that may be very good for some sound absorption within the room, but it doesn't help my kid who's hyper allergic to the kind of stuff that collects in rugs.
Right.
So it gets very complicated very quickly, but not intellectually complicated, just sociopolitical complicated.
Well, is there sound material that can be added to the walls and the ceiling that don't impact with dust collection or things like that? Or does all material attract dust?
No, there's lots of materials. I mean, the standard acoustic tiles, and that's been around again for more than half a century. You can go into any building supply house and get the kind of materials, but you have to write a check to get the materials. They're made explicitly for this purpose. Now, these are sound absorption materials and don't necessarily do much for sound isolation. So you first have to determine, is the noise internally generated or externally generated, because that makes a difference in how you handle it.
Are there any studies that teach us about how much sound should go into a classroom that above which affects learning?
People talk about it. I haven't seen any studies, and I suspect it's a much more complicated question you're asking. Urban children who grow up in a metropolitan area are probably more tolerant to sound than others. And there's some oddball argument, which may in fact be valid, that if you get the environment too close, because the auditory system, especially in kids who haven't blown their ears out, is pretty damn good, you merely pick up the sounds that are there. In fact, it's essentially impossible to suppress all noise. If you have a very quiet environment, you just simply hear very quiet sounds. So there's an argument to go in the other direction of injecting some background which covers up these things. And just to do a digression, there's a kind of scientific space called now an anechoic chamber, which is designed to essentially suppress all internal and external sounds that's used for measurement purposes. You go into this chamber, if it's a very good one, and there aren't that many left, and you can hear your biologic functions in your body. You can hear the blood flowing in your veins.
Cool.
Well, people freak out, and it's a very bizarre experience if you've gone into it, because nobody except these scientists has ever heard a space that's totally free of sound. And all it is you hear your bodily functions going on.
Ooh.
It's very freaky.
Well, I know there's some experiments with sound for people who have ringing in their ears of making a compensating sound envelope, sort of, that hides the sound in their ears.
Yeah, that's actually another whole big topic. It turns out there's a nonprofit organization, I think it's the American Tinnitus Organization, which does a very, very good job of distributing information, sponsoring research on this. And there's actually a fairly large percentage of the population, some estimates have gone as high as 20 or 30 million, who have some degree of ringing in their ears. And it's really sort of internally self-generated noise. It's not coming through your ears. It's your auditory cortex and other parts of your auditory system generating it. The problem is it's not a single diagnosis. It's really a syndrome, and it's become a catch-all for maybe half a dozen different pathologies, which all are labeled tinnitus. And the way you handle them really depends on the individual case. Most of these people have it, if they get involved in it, become their own guinea pigs, because there's not a lot known, and it's only recently that people have actually started focusing on it.
Yeah, there was a CD out that you played and you had earphones on, and it was sort of like wild kind of random noise, like that, and for about 5 or 10 minutes, and that, when you took the headphones off, the ringing in your ears wasn't there anymore.
For a certain class of tinnitus, it seems to work quite well, because the argument there is that what's going on is your brain hasn't gotten enough high-frequency energy, and so it sort of amplifies its own high-frequency sounds that aren't real. When you start exciting that part of the inner ear and give it some real excitation to chew on, it stops generating its own. But that seems to work in one class of tinnitus people and not necessarily in other classes. And there's different origins. Some of them may be genetic, some may be drug chemicals. Aspirin is known to, an aspirin-like drug is known to often produce this in terms of excessive noise.
Really?
It's a very complex business, and they're only recently beginning to really study it. It's not a single catch-all. It's not like a sprained leg.
So how much aspirin winds up being injurious to you?
Well, again, I actually have a low-level version and have been sort of managing myself. Mine started when I had some knee joint problems in the 60s, and in those days the doctor said, take as much aspirin as you can tolerate. believing that the maximum dose was a stomach issue, an intestinal issue. In fact, that was the origin of tinnitus for me. And eventually they said, you know, take as much as until you begin to get some auditory effect. There are a lot of drugs out there that actually have these side effects of doing temporary or permanent damage to your inner ear and auditory cortex. And again, most of the medical community is not as well aware of it as they perhaps should be. So it pays to be self-educated and really understand that everything has some artifact, and one of them is your auditory system.
So if you reduce the amount of aspirin you take, does it affect the ringing?
To some people it gets better. For some people, once the damage is done, it's permanent.
Well, I know my damage was done by a firecracker on top of a building.
Yep.
So the genesis of that is well known, but it's not curable.
No, and depending on the nature of the damage, you may, some of these self-managed techniques may work for you. You know, one of them worked for me, so you got to basically experiment, but other people have had failures. Some people have taken a drug for some kind of flu or other disease and magically found it made it better. Again, if you have it, it's really worth subscribing to this nonprofit. I think it's $35 a year. And these guys are very knowledgeable. They cut the hype out. They do a lot of double-blind experiments. They evaluate all the choices. They publish testimonials from people who say, yeah, this really worked for me, and this is the kind of difficulty I have. If you have it, it's definitely worth supporting. They're a good group.
Mm-hmm. There was some talk a while ago about having digital hearing aids that could then compensate.
Well, I have my own views of the hearing aid industry. They try very hard. Some of them work some of the time for some class of the people. A significant percentage of the population finds they make life worse than better. So if you blow your hearing out, you'll get some mechanical aid and things will be normal, don't go there. It's a very tough business. And even there, hearing difficulties are not a monolithic category. A certain kind of hearing aid may help one person, and it may be nothing for another kind of person. My uncle, who damaged his ears in World War II, has gone through a lot of different hearing aids, and none of them really work for him.
So the answer, if you blow your ears out, is to learn American Sign Language.
Well, you basically learn to adapt to a whole class of limitations in your life. It's not a trivial business, and I strongly recommend preserve your hearing if you want to preserve your mental health.
So how can we best teach our kids to turn the volume down?
But I have a thesis, and that is the preachy kind of don't do it because it hurts probably is completely ineffectual. I recommend a teacher in a classroom say, who wants to be part of an exciting experiment? And you get one kid who wears headphones that produce, you know, noise, ringing, and, you know, some other stuff, and you create a functional deafness, and this kid has to go around for 24 hours never taking the headphones off and then write a story about what the experience is. So then he's sitting in the lunchroom and all his friends are telling jokes. He can't hear them. You know, what is it really like? And do it more as a sort of anthropologic, personal, biographical story rather than by some elder saying, you know, don't do it because you'll be sorry. I don't think that's effective. And partly, I think there's a question that nobody's asked, and that is, why do people turn the volume up too loud? And I think there are some real answers, and I think people would find they would understand the socio-psychological dynamic more if they asked that question instead of how can they force kids to behave better.
And why do they turn the volume up?
Well, I have a bunch of speculation. Some of it's
Speculate.
Okay, some of it's based on fragmentary evidence. Some of it's based on a little bit stronger evidence. There was one researcher who studied some of the students at, I think it was Northeastern University here in Boston many years ago, and she observed that a group of kids who had always listened to loud music, when she took it away from them, I think a small percentage, like 10 or 20%, exhibited withdrawal symptoms as if you had taken an addictive drug away from them.
Huh.
And the sort of implication, but again, she didn't pursue it and it wasn't funded, was that loud sounds, like a lot of other things, changes your brain. Mm-hmm. It's not just illegal drugs. It's everything has an influence on your brain. And the loud music, for reasons, again, I can speculate, changes your experience, your sensory cognitive connection experiences. And my argument is the auditory system is wired in so many places in the brain and so deep. From an evolutionary perspective, it was always on. It's 24/7. You have no ear lids. It was just very important, and it allows you to place yourself in an oral space, which always aligned with the visual space. And when you play loud music, you're taken out of that space. You're functionally deaf. So in an odd way, the louder the music, the less you're connected. So it's sort of transporting you to another space, almost a fantasy space. You probably can't daydream when you're listening to loud music. Sort of intoxicating. It grabs every piece of your awareness. It probably lowers your sensitivity to vision and smell. In fact, I believe in the 70s, a group of dental researchers were experimenting using sound as a way of deadening the pain. It never went anywhere, or they never reported it, or maybe it was produced, the sound was too loud. I never could find that research. I know it happened, but loud sounds do something for you. You've got to deal with why people want to do it to themselves before you can say don't do it.
Wasn't there some research or speculation that the beat in the music, a sexual urge or feeling of acceptance?
I don't know if it was so much that. It may be, and again, there's a lot of fragmentary literature, but it does synchronize a whole bunch of brain activities to the beat. And one of the arguments, as a species, we evolved to be connected and to be connected to the external world and external people. And certainly a strong beat will connect you. It sort of, you know, synchronizes everybody's brain in the group if they're all listening to the same music. There's some, again, fragmentary evidence. I'm not sure it's sexual. It may be, it may not be, but certainly it does something to your brain, and I think that's the place we ought to start.
Right, yeah, there was some conversation about rock and roll with the beat, that was promoting promiscuousness because it put people in the space where they were willing to do whatever.
Well, I think the key element is it puts you in a new space, and whether that new space is sexual, whether it's high adrenaline, whether it's the exhilaration of a roller coaster, it may vary. In fact, there's one group of anthropologists who studied trance-like behavior, which is often induced by sounds, and there were sort of religious rituals mm-hmm. where trance was used as part of the ritual, and sound was an important part of it. You can do odd things with sound, and these people did it. I mean, there were cultures all over the world at one time that were doing it. In fact, here it is. It's called Music and Trance, by Gilbert Roget. Again, all this stuff is known. It's just it's not known within the general culture.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. No matter how much music there is and how much beat there is, if somebody is unattractive to you at the beginning of the beat and the end of the beat, it's going to be the same.
Probably. I doubt whether it's an aphrodisiac. I think it's basically a transport process. In the same way that alcohol is a depressant, even though it may liberate you from your inhibitions, it's really medically a depressant.